Thank you very much.
After that very nice ride of optimism, I do not like my talk anymore because I have to talk about nuclear power. So this is joint work with Caroline Fisher, who's here, who you will hear in the afternoon, and Marie-Hélène Huber, who's at the University of Rennes. And my goal is to sort of talk about nuclear power and the role of nuclear today, and then try to tell you a little bit about some preliminary results from a modeling exercise that we are trying to do, and we were still getting results last night, so it's very preliminary. And then sort of provide a longer term perspective on nuclear, which might tie in well with the previous talk and others today and yesterday. So here is your world electricity output by fuel in 2013. And you can see, well, you still have that 800-pound gorilla called coal supplying 42% of electricity. And as you know from before and all the discussion we've had, electricity is the sector where a lot of changes could happen if you were to transit from fossil fuels to alternative resources. If you look at hydro, that's 16%. There's natural gas, 22%. Nuclear is 11%. And if you think about the aggregate size of the electricity market in the world, it's about 23,000 terawatt hour. I'll talk a little bit about terawatt hour, 10 to the 12 watt hours, I guess. Oil is 4%, so not much oil is produced from electricity. This is actually, I doubt if you can see it from the back, but essentially nuclear power plants in different countries and plants under construction. So maybe this picture is a little more readable. So you can see here, well, just go back one step. There's about 380 gigawatt equivalent of nuclear capacity today, and about 65 gigawatts that is under construction. So who are the big actors in this game? Well, again, it's China. So China has a lot of nuclear plants under construction. If you go back here, I think China has 24 plants out of a total of 67 plants that are at various stages of construction, including five in the United States. So here Russia also has relatively aggressive nuclear plants under construction. India, about six. And then you have US and Korea and the UAE and other nations. So that's the number of reactors June 2015. So let me give you a little bit of nuclear power 101. Well, like I said before, current installed capacity is about 380 gigawatt equivalent. So if you take this capacity and run it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks in the year, then you basically get per gigawatt, if you just do the sort of multiplication, you get about 8.76 terawatt hours. However, what we actually get from the 380 is about 2,400. So the efficiency is about 70%. In terms of generation. Now, there are some studies, for example, by Lucas Davis and Catherine Wolfram recently that show that in the US, the efficiencies are much higher. I guess in France, too, the efficiencies would be significant. In the US, it's about 94%. So essentially what you end up getting is about 2,400. In other developing countries, nuclear plants do not work as efficiently. Even in the United States, as this study shows, the plants that have been deregulated perform better than the ones that are that have not been deregulated. So the average annual growth of nuclear capacity is about 14, 15 gigawatts. The IEA projects that by 2040, you'll have about 767 compared to 380-odd gigawatts today. So what we did in our sort of modeling exercise is take this sort of linear, interpolation between 2014 and 2040 and then say, well, how much of extra nuclear capacity are you going to have, are you going to get in the next, you know, coming years? And it essentially boils down to about 95 terawatt hours. So if you look at the, you know, proportional sort of allocation of this capacity between different countries, well, what we did, again, to make our model tractable is to divide the world into three regions. China is one, because a lot of things, as we heard in the last 2 days, happened because of what's, you know, going on in China, or Chinese decisions and energy plans. So China gets about 50% of that incremental nuclear capacity, and North America gets about 15%, and the rest of the world, gets about 35%. So that's how we allocate our planned capacity for nuclear in the coming years. So for China, this means pretty significant annual growth of about 47 terawatt hours. If you look at 2014, Chinese nuclear output was about 124 terawatt hours. So about 37-38%, I would guess. Well, there is another problem with nuclear, which is, as we have seen in the United States, is that a lot of the plants are aging. So you can see here years in operation on the x-axis, a number of reactors. And, you know, there are, relatively few new nuclear plants being brought into the pipeline. And there's tons of plants that are really old. Of course, in the United States, plants that have been operating for 30, 40 years have had to go through a major exercise, meet federal standards and so forth, to be relicensed for another 30, 40 years. So you have to upgrade and so forth. And that is, again, a big challenge faced by the nuclear industry, or would be in the years to come. How do you let these plants die, as some countries have done, or do you, improve them and bring them and run them again for another three or four decades? So here is your carbon content for different, fossil fuels. We know this story very well. Coal generates more carbon than oil and natural gas, and that is in our model. I'm going to begin talking a little bit about our model and the sort of preliminary attempt to get some idea of the role of nuclear in the future in terms of carbon emissions and possible pro-nuclear policies. We have a very simple idea here. We could do a whole bunch of scenarios. We just take a nuclear sort of planned capacity expansion, like the one I mentioned to you, and compare it to a nuclear freeze. So suppose we all become Germany and Japan, well, not quite Japan, but more like Germany, and say, no more nuclear, let's just stop and keep it constant at 380-odd gigawatt equivalent. How would that impact sort of global allocation, regional allocation of different resources for energy? So we are looking at primarily things like coal use, renewable use, carbon emissions, and leakage between countries, which often turns out to be quite important. And here again, you can see the numbers for China are especially interesting, so we focus on Chinese energy use. Well, how does this model work? Within economics, Nordhaus did a model in the 1970s looking at the effect of OPEC oil prices, a sort of partial equilibrium model where we only look at the energy sector, divide it into residential, transport, commercial energy, and then electricity that is used in different sectors, end-use sectors. So it's a partial equilibrium model. We do not consider what happens beyond energy. And then we have these three regions I described to you. North America has US, Canada, Mexico. Rest of the world has the EU, Russia, India. So some big actors there. And energy inputs are all the major resources. So coal, oil, natural gas. We aggregate renewable energy. I'll talk a little bit about that issue. Renewable energy could be hydro, biomass, solar and wind, as we heard so much about just now. And then we have nuclear power. And then the energy consuming sectors are those at the end. So this is how the schematic looks like. Essentially, you convert these resources. These resources come at some cost of extraction and refining and so forth. And then you convert them at some cost to the electric or non-electric sort of use. And then finally, you convert them to final energy. There may be cost and efficiency losses between each of these stages. So so here is a typical sort of energy supply curve. You know, we have upward sloping curves in each region. So here, in this model, we have had to go from the country level to aggregate at the regional level. And the costs are you know, rising as you extract more. But these costs may also be impacted by learning by doing. So obviously, like we saw, we heard just now, there may be major learning by doing effects as the size of the market expands, that these costs might reduce. And that is especially important in things like renewables, but it's also important for fossil fuel resources, for example. Imagine more efficient cars being produced, and that means that 1 gallon of oil goes farther in terms of, you know, miles traveled. So we had to, you know, one reason I have preliminary results is because we had to play around a lot to get the model to replicate base year, you know, numbers with these three regions. And essentially, we have transport costs that equal baseline price differential. So we had to account for export and import. And the way we do it is by putting in transport costs. And then we have a final energy production equation. So here are some typical costs. I'm just not going to talk too much about the model. It's preliminary, but just to give you an idea, you can see these are extraction costs and for different regions. And you can see coal is pretty low cost in North America relative to China, which has higher cost. And oil, obviously, is similar for North America, China, but cheaper for RO with all the Middle Eastern countries and so forth. Gas is, again, cheaper for you know, the United States, primarily in North America, and then more expensive for China and sort of moderate for RO. Now, if you look at the cost of supplying electricity by region and fuel, here, actually, what you see is you know, a bit of the optimistic message we just heard. Look at the cost of renewables versus, you know, other resources like coal and gas and nuclear for different regions. And this is in dollars per megawatt hour. And you can see renewables look really good. In for the case of China especially, you know, $30 per megawatt hour relative to nuclear, which is 50. Now, the problem here is, of course, you know, what renewable are we talking about? Are we talking about hydro? Again, that opens a whole can of worms in terms of, you know, all the land use issues, settlement, and what have you, capacity, limited capacity of hydro. So when you have large expansions in each of these sectors, maybe some of these costs will go up because the marginal costs will increase. And so here is our sectoral demand as a function of regional GDP and the price of energy. So what we do is we aggregate the country GDP into regional GDP. And so demand is a function of some constant and the price in that sector, and then some measure of regional GDP. You can do it either GDP per capita and add population, which we did in a previous paper, and, you know, include population growth exogenously in the model, or you can use estimates for you know, for GDP for each region. So here is our annual income data by region, and you can see again that the significant, well, North America, not much income growth projected, you know, by other people, EIA, for example, but China, big, as everyone knows, and RO is also pretty significant. So those drive some of these results. You know, moratorium on nuclear capacity and planned nuclear growth are the only two things we talk about. So here is your planned nuclear growth, like I mentioned, the interpolation with the projections. And you can see North America, some growth in nuclear, but China is coming from a small base, and RO is also a reasonable growth rate. So I just go through this here. So what the other sort of exercise we do is we say, well, you know, we are looking at nuclear, no nuclear, but we don't have any carbon targets. So what we do is we impose a carbon target, essentially a carbon tax with nuclear growth. So can we impose a $50 per ton of, you know, constant $2,005 per ton of CO2, which obviously is constant in present value terms, in the model and see what difference does it make between freezing nuclear capacity and letting it grow at planned rates. And hopefully you can see this. So here is our, the interesting numbers are in the right, and you can see the emission reductions. And this is a comparison between planned nuclear with carbon tax and without carbon tax. So with carbon tax, obviously, you have to reduce fossil fuel use that is carbon intensive. So you can see that China reduces by about 22% in 2030. So these are all 2030 numbers with and without carbon tax. And Roe also has to reduce emissions, annual emissions, by about 20%, and North America by 15%. And that's the kind of story we would like to see happen with the carbon tax. So here is a comparison between just looking at the electricity sector and in 2011 and what happens in 2030. So like I said earlier, you can see in 2011, a lot of renewables, a lot of coal, 79%, sort of, and it's, the numbers are not too far off today. And nuclear is small and gas is small in China. So that's sort of the harsh reality of it. But here is your, comparison in 2030 of different, different mix of fossil fuels. So you can see at the bottom is planned nuclear with the emissions target, and the planned nuclear with no emissions target in the middle. And then on the top, you have nuclear freeze and no emissions target. So, the top two lines are, without any emissions target. So you can see that with and without nuclear, if you do not impose a carbon tax, well, something's happened. I mean, obviously, in China, nuclear share goes up from 2%, which is today, to about 14% under planned nuclear. But how is it, what is it displacing? Well, it's displacing some renewables, actually. So, the interesting thing is, given the cost structure, if you freeze nuclear expansion in China, what you might see ultimately, which is I think good news, is that you'll see a larger share of renewables. You also actually, because of nuclear, well, the bad thing is that you're displacing from renewables. The good thing is you're also reducing some coal use. And not much is happening to natural gas. And I think Marty asked this question before, and in Kathleen's session, well, how much gas will China be able to extract? And there may be some serious questions there in terms of, they do have huge potential. They have the biggest reserves, more than the United States, but it's not clear how much China will extract in 2030, at least in our model, unless some major technological adaptation occurs. So here is your, 47% now when you apply the carbon target, renewables become big. 47% of the electricity supply comes from nuclear, and that's a nice number if you're pro renewables, and 37% with coal. So we can see that carbon tax really works in this framework. So what about output? Now I showed you the shares, but notice if you do not impose a carbon tax, well, with no emissions target and planned nuclear, at the size of the electricity sector actually increases some, and because the costs are lower and the demand increases. But what happens in China is if you go from 8,000 terawatt hours to about 6,000 terawatt hours under carbon tax. So what you want to do is not just worry about obviously the mix, but also the size of the electricity sector, and that comes down about 30%. So here is your United States, and you can see again that coal is 40%, renewables 20%, and 5,000 terawatt hours. The size of the electricity sector in China becomes bigger over time and becomes the leading energy-consuming electricity sector, at least in the world in 2030. But here is your numbers for the United States. Not much changes except under a carbon tax, when your renewable share goes up quite a bit, and you have high gas use in the United States, as we know. So again, the size of the sector does not decline too much in the US with the carbon tax. Rho is sort of moderate sensitive between the two cases. And you can see in Rho also, you have high renewables and a reasonable share of coal, but more equitably distributed, so to speak, between the different resources. And again, here, you can see coal use declines from 20 to 12%, and nuclear takes a 16% share. Okay, there is also some decline in the electricity output in Rho under carbon tax, as we would expect. Well, global emissions declined by about 18% in the scenario without tax. So, with tax. So, what are the main sort of takeaways from this exercise? Like I said, it's a really preliminary, it's preliminary work. Well, obviously we get big reductions in coal use, but only with carbon tax. I mean, in China, for example, nuclear is just too small to make some big impacts. To deliver a sort of clean energy alone, it needs a carbon tax or some sort of target to be able to deliver more in terms of renewable share. And it's surprising that renewables do occupy a big share under these scenarios. Gas share does not budge, at least not in China, and big impacts in China and Rho. So here is your, well, we need to do some more work. We need to get cost estimates of these tax policies and pro-nuclear policies. The question I have is, well, you know, are these large shares of renewables realistic? What renewable are we talking about? Is this hydro? Is it biofuels? Is it solar and wind? And what may be their own impacts? Some of these renewables may have some problems. So we need to disaggregate in this model. Not only disaggregate the renewables, but also disaggregate across regions. Maybe split a row into EU and Russia and India, and because the Russia and India have aggressive nuclear programs. How will these old plants be replaced, if at all? That's an important question. The other thing I think came out really this morning and the last talk is the learning in other technologies. So there is nuclear learning in renewables, but there's also learning in nuclear. And if you look at the literature, some of these new designs they're much better at damage control if the hot core inside melts and so forth, graphite cooled reactors and so forth. The problem is, as we just heard, if nuclear is not being used, you will not get significant R&D and learning in that sector. So that is tied to the new nuclear plants being operated and installed. So that will provide incentives to firms to come out with better technologies. We did a study when Roger and Nick Stern organized a conference some years ago, and this was sort of based on Kyoto targets, and we found that the nuclear could meet half the cost of meeting Kyoto targets. And what's interesting today, and this is again, things are so dynamic in this sector, that I don't think these conclusions would hold today, because at that time, nuclear was replacing coal and so forth. But now, obviously with solar and wind, there's a new game in town. And so the role of nuclear in mitigating, carbon targets at lower cost may be questionable. I want to end with two pictures. So one is uranium prices. What are happening with, obviously nuclear has, not expanded as we have expected, or maybe 10, 15 years ago. And you can see there was a peak in uranium prices. They have fallen quite a bit. I mean, it's about, $80, $90 a kilo. So they are not going up. There was a concern that a significant proliferation of nuclear for civilian use would trigger an increase in uranium prices, because uranium is a non-renewable resource. Not sure if that is going to happen. But here is the other picture, which is, look at the difference between, this is time on the x-axis, and uranium supply from mines and uranium consumption. Those are the two top lines, civilian power demand and naval demand, military demand. So if you look at the top line, that's the aggregate demand. How much of it is supplied by mines? So you see that big white area in the middle? That's basically the former Soviet Union and the United States agreeing to dismantle bombs. So if you dismantle nuclear bombs, you get 25 times more uranium And that depressed prices for a long time in the market. I'm told that there are 45,000 bombs waiting in arsenals, I guess, and only 5,000 have been dismantled. We don't need that many bombs to destroy the planet. Only a few are enough. So if there's more disarmament treaties, you will probably see significant supply of uranium. That might drive down prices quite a bit, although capital costs are the big part of nuclear generation, not so much variable costs. And the bottom line is that nuclear will be a major fuel. It may not be the panacea for solving the world's clean energy problem. And we have to decide how we want to approach how we want to think of nuclear policy. Are we going to let these plants die or continue to live with a bunch of plants that are old and may have some issues down the road? Thank you.